paid into Medicare for decades. Don't spend retirement limping. The Joint Relief Institute treats joint pain fast. It's covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000.
All right, everybody, it's Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. Very happy you can join us on this Saturday night, early Sunday morning, and on this Father's Day, 312-981-7200. You can call, you can text anytime throughout the show. Good morning, Mr. Banish, to you.
Good morning, sir. Happy Dad's Day.
Thank you very much. I'm in a chair that's like below the council here.
Well, can you know, there's like 50,000 buttons.
Yes.
You know, and you don't know which one. Don't do the one that where your seat back suddenly goes flying backwards.
But I feel like I'm at like the kids' table. I'm not high enough for some reason. That's all right. And joining us today, folks, so I thought that'd be pretty cool. And we talked about it last week because it's Father's Day. Yeah. We thought we'd invite my son, Josh, 15 years old, in the studio. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
And welcome in. Glad you could be here.
Happy Father's Day.
Thank you very much.
Happy Father's Day, Mr. Baddish.
Why, thank you, sir.
There you go. So, Josh, you know, I've got a... Josh is 15. We have 11... He's got an 11-year-old sister, Emma, and then Alex is our soon-to-be 4 years old. So we have a very big span in our family, and unfortunately, I always have to say this, but it is the same family, because sometimes they say, well, you got a 15-year-old and you got a 4-year-old, you must have... you know, is this your second wife? Is this your no? This is we just did a little oops at the end there, and it's not even he's not even an oops. He's just like a pleasant little surprise.
You took a long vacation.
Yeah, we took a long vacation, but we celebrated Father's Day already a little bit this weekend. The three generations of our family. My sister came into town and got to go up to Wisconsin, where we've been all weekend and doing some boating and hanging out. And you know, Roger, you know, I love the supper club.
Yeah.
We did the Duck Inn up in Delavan, Wisconsin, which is my favorite little Friday mm-hmm. night fish fry and some old fashions. And we splurged and got Brandy Alexander and Grasshopper.
Oh, some old fashioned drinks.
Yeah, but they're doing pink squirrels and all this other stuff, and I don't even know what happened.
Rusty nails,
exactly. But we had a pretty good time. What did we do all weekend, buddy?
Fishing, tubing, what else? Board games.
Yeah, we did some board games. See, that's another thing, too, that I think is really important that our family does is
some bonding.
Yeah, some good bonding. And, he's got his Xbox, Roger. He's got all that stuff, too. But I think it's important that you actually sit down and face one another and have a conversation. So the board games are important.
Yep, very important. We have a whole stack at home.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, they're gathering dust, but we have a whole stack at home. But yeah, we used to play until Bridget got, angry and drove everyone away.
Oh, gotcha. There was an old Carol Burnett skit about playing Sorry. I don't know if you remember that with Vicki Lawrence and as Eunice. Do you remember that?
Oh, my God. Yeah, I think I do. Yeah,
absolute classic. But what are some of the board games we're playing these days?
We kind of brought a collection of Monopoly games.
We did. So we brought Peanuts Monopoly up north, but I grew up with Life, so we played Life a lot.
Great game.
Yeah,
Love that game. Yeah, with the little cars.
Yep. And then what else did we play at home?
Left, right, center. Brought a deck of cards. Played some King's Corners and Goldfish and...
Yeah,
very cool.
So they're playing some cards too. Yeah, they're playing some cards too.
You should teach them bridge.
Could do that. Yep.
Bridge.
Yep.
I'm a kamikaze bridge player.
For money.
Well, learn how to play first and then bring the money in.
Why not? But it was nice because we got to hang out with the cousins and all that good stuff. And, what did you – did you fish fry last night? What did you have?
I asked whatever was all you could eat and then ended up only eating one plate.
He's a 15-year-old kid. He's hungry.
Well, of course.
But you get all the all-you-can-eat potato pancakes. They have relish trays.
That's the way to go.
Right? Don't you think? And they have relish trays for $1.50. So you want to talk about throwback food, throwback experience. So you get little relish trays and stuff and good dessert. And you get the little breadsticks with the cheddar cheese and the garlic butter. I mean, it's literally like, old-fashioned 1970s Wisconsin. But we stay in a vintage inn up there, and it's a friend of mine who runs and owns the place. And And we got to swim around the pool a little bit. And I got to tell you something. I've heard reports lately, and I'm sure you've seen them too, on, you know, the condition of some of these pools and what the CDC has been saying about swimming and in these public spaces. And, you know, I was on the boat driving the kids around and tubing all day, and I needed to cool off, so I wanted to go jump in the pool. And I just all of a sudden started thinking what all these, you know, reporters were talking about. We pulled some gross facts about swimming pools. Josh, what's the first one here?
You're swimming around in strangers' urine.
Yeah, see, that's not pleasant.
No. But isn't the chlorine supposed to, like, kill all of that?
No,
chlorine only does the algae and stuff.
The smell of the chlorine, when you think you're smelling chlorine in a pool, we'll get to that.
Please don't.
The smell is not the chlorine. It's the smell of the chlorine fighting the bacteria and not winning right away.
Oops.
Hello. So tell us what you say about this one. 1 in 5 people?
1 in 5 people in the U.S. have admitted to peeing in the pool, according to a survey conducted by the Water Quality and Health Council.
Guilty.
Oh, gosh. I don't want to hear
that. Did that come out of your mouth?
No,
come on.
That came out of Joey. Oh, my gosh. Now, let me tell you something. My 3-year-old swims around in the pool, and he swims around in the lake with us, because we'll go up to Lake Geneva or Lake, you know, whatever. And he asks to go to the bathroom at 3 years old or 2 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the kids that you almost think, well, they're going to do it. They're just, when he was little, we put swimmers on him so that he could, you know, almost go in the little diaper swimmer thing, but he has to get out of the pool and go to the bathroom. That's the way it should be.
Right. Why do you think they have bathrooms at the swimming pool?
If he's 3 years old and he's smart enough to know not to swim around in his own pee, I think that's a good thing.
People older than him should be able to.
Yeah, they should be able to handle that, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. Fine, I'll shut up.
Okay. Joey. All right, how about this one, Josh?
There's also loads, literally, of poo in your pool.
Yeah. Okay, let's read that. Go ahead, Josh.
The average swimmer overloads at least 0.14 grams of fecal matter into a swimming pool within the first 15 minutes of entering, according to a study from the U.S.-based Center for Disease Control.
Wow.
This figure is likely to be even higher if the swimmer is questioned. Is a particularly gross individual who doesn't see the need to wipe. That's nice.
This is horrible. This is a CNN report, by the way, we're reading here.
That means you're supposed to take a shower before you go.
See, now that's the other thing. I think people think that because they're going in the pool, they don't need to shower.
And they trust the chlorine.
You need to take a shower.
And the kids, you know, even your sister, you know, we're before we get up this morning, we're like, you're showering before we go to breakfast in the pool. She's like, well, we're going in the pool. We're going to get chlorine and stuff. We have to shower afterwards. Well, you're going to shower before and you're going to shower after. And we do that with everybody. You have to do that.
See, they taught you that at the YMCA.
Right.
You have to take a shower before you can go in the pool. You got to walk through the showers, actually. You got to take a shower before and after.
Yeah, that was a Cub Scout thing, actually, I think,
too. Oh, also Cub Scouts?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I'm going to read this one because I don't want to make Josh do all the gross stuff, but you can get diarrhea. According to the CDC, there's been a rise in people getting that and other illnesses from a contaminated pool over the last decades, and that is because?
It's because chlorine doesn't kill everything.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. No longer can you kid yourself that the chlorine will deal with it. Sorry to tell you this, but it won't. Apparently, chlorine and other disinfectants don't actually kill germs instantly, so you're still at risk for some types of bacteria.
And you're thinking about get some of this water in your mouth and stuff. It's like, oh, my God. It's not that, you know, and I want to go swim. I want to go have a good time. I want to go to the lake. I want to go to the pool. I want to enjoy myself. But some of this stuff, I feel like I got to wear a big plastic bag before I dump in there.
Yeah, I'm going to wrap myself in cellophane from head to toe.
Yeah.
Yeah, and have a breathing apparatus of some type.
Or a muzzle.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. So the smell that you smell that you think is chlorine, which, by the way, there's a whole other study on what chlorine are these chemicals that are touching your skin that cause cancer. So this is not.
Oh, great.
So it's actually caused by chlorine mixing with all the urine, sweat and other disgusting bodily fluids people have been secreting into the water. So the dirtier your pool, the more it smells. So if you go to the pool and you smell that chlorine, It is just fighting off bacteria. That's what that is. I'll tell you, the
YMCA pools must have been horrendously filthy then.
Yeah,
because you walked, you could smell it before you opened the door.
Oh, the high schools. You smell when you go into
those
high school.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Eye itching, that's not the chlorine. It's actually the urine in the pool also.
Oh, God. It's a miracle I'm still alive. Jeez.
I'm done reading this
discussion. Thank you so much.
All right.
Thank you. Happy Father's Day, everybody.
How about some happy pool news? How about that?
Okay.
Let's see here. Facts about swimming. Swimming is the most popular recreational activity for children, 7 to 17. Swimming is the fourth most popular sport or activity in the U.S. A hour of swimming will burn up to 650 calories. How much do you think it would cost to put in an in-ground pool if you're going to put one in the yard?
Oh, my gosh. A full, like, you know, cement and all this kind?
Yeah.
In-ground pool.
In-ground pool.
Not Olympic size.
No.
Okay. I'd say $30,000.
Yeah, pretty close. $22,000.
Okay.
$22,000 to put an in-ground. Average cost to build an above-ground pool when you're really doing, like, not just going and buying one at Target, but you're really putting in a real pool. It's about $6,000. Chemicals per month is about $87.
Jeez.
And Americans spend about $1 million on their swimming pools a year. Mm. So it is a hobby of what's the most popular pool game when you're in the pool?
I'd say, volleyball. Over the, throwing a net in there and volleyball.
Actually, Marco Polo.
Marco Polo.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. And you know what? I didn't even know what Marco Polo was until The Sopranos were playing it in the pool. I know. It's where I get all my information from.
Is he led such a sheltered life.
What's the most popular jump in the pool?
Cannonball.
Of course. 38% of in-ground pools have diving boards, I guess so. Ancient drawings and paintings found in Egypt depict people swimming back to 2500 BC.
That was a long swim.
That was...
Sorry.
That was a long swim.
Well, you said...
Who invented the swim fin?
A guy by the name of Finn, actually. Finn McGregor.
Finn McGregor.
Uh-huh. And he, because there was so much water around his place, and he just felt he could get through it faster if he had these fins on, and he named them after him.
Roger's a teacher, so he has all the information. It was Benjamin Franklin.
Okay. No.
Who did that. Who put a swimming pool in the White House? Think about what generation, what era would that be that you would think?
Oh,
a swimming pool
in the White House. FDR.
FDR inside, and who did outside?
Oh, outside Kennedy?
It was Ford.
Oh,
it was way
really?
Into the 70s. It was
and I'll tell you why FDR, why that automatically came to mind, is because of his paralysis.
Yeah, that's right.
And
it was
that,
more for
this was for his
therapy.
Right.
Yeah.
See, ooh, I geez.
Look at you. You are
wow.
You
wait
are
a minute.
Something.
That's all I can remember today. That
take some money out of petty cash.
Yeah, right.
Take some money out of petty cash. So Father's Day today. So here we are. Here, let me get up to the mic. Father's Day today. Throwing out the garbage. Big day today, and I have to tell you that. My dad, Leroy Plyer is his name, and he. You know, he's been working all of his life. He's about 76 years old, which really does kind of surprise me a little bit. Like, where did the years go that my dad is 76? And he quit working, I think he was about 67, 68. He was an executive with Pace.
Mm-hmm.
He worked for Shure Brothers Microphone. And, you know, that was one of the coolest jobs because he would always, you know, I'd see his company newsletter sitting on the counter and it'd be, like him handing a golden microphone to Donnie and Marie to Sonny and Cher stuff in the 70s. It was pretty, pretty cool. But, you know, here this is really cool, and I want to talk about my dad a little bit. And then, Josh, please take all the time you want to talk about me.
Josh is thinking, whatever.
He, my dad has been a pillar in his community, and we grew up in a smaller town over in Schiller Park. And a dedicated public service, he's always been, really since he was – in his 20s. I mean, I was a kid and he was on all kinds of committees. So he has literally celebrated 50 years in his community, working for the community. And I was looking at the things that he had done and, you know, village trustee for almost 20 years. It was 1968 when he joined the zoning board in this town. He was like, he was on the cable committee. He was on airport ecology, ordinances, public property, building plats, space needs. I'm looking at this list: flood control, planning, and zoning. He was mayor pro tem for a while he was doing a full time a job. And besides that, you know, a member of the American Legion, Kiwanis Club, Moose Club, chairman of the American Cancer Society, head of the Knights of Columbus for our church, you know, a school board president, advisory board, St. Vincent de Paul, still delivering food to the poor, still goes every week and counts all the money for the church. I mean, this guy is like nonstop. But, you know, at 76, he's also my mother's caregiver. My mother's got a lot of ailments. She's, mm-hmm. she's got diabetes. She's got heart issues and so forth. She's partially blind. So my dad is doing all that as well. And he finally said, you know what, he's on the he's a police and fire commissioner for town. And he finally said, you know what, I'm going to hang up that hat. And so a couple weeks ago, he attended his last meeting. I actually went to his last meeting, and then we went out to Gibson's and we had some drinks and some appetizers and hung out and celebrated all of his time. And then I was excited for him. I mean, that's, you know, think about this,
mm-hmm.
you know,
sure.
76 years old and finally hung up his hat after working and volunteering and everything else. And I know he's going to still do stuff for his church and so forth. But, you know, at some point, he said to me about a week ago, he says, well, the guy they appointed turned it down, so I guess I'm going back next week.
Oh,
and,
no.
Yeah, I know.
I know.
They drug him back. Yes, they drug him back.
Every time I try to get out, they keep pulling me back
That's
in.
That's it. And, you know, and he said, you know, I knew I was going to do a little transition and so mm-hmm. forth, but he's back in. But love my wow. father. And, again, you know, his not only has his leadership been an incredible asset to the community, but the example he has set as an inspiration for me and others, and I'm so proud to be a son and feel blessed that I've had such a wonderful role model to follow. And he's been such an example of love and honesty and leadership and integrity for my entire life. And it's because of that I've made, you know, I do volunteerism and I participate in public service as well, and I'm on several boards involved in my church and all that good stuff. So happy Father's Day, Dad. Love you, and honestly, just a great example. Now, Josh, go ahead.
No pressure. I'm not prepared.
Yeah, start at number one on the list there, Josh. That he
yeah,
get,
please.
No,
I know right. You typed it all out.
One, two, three.
Just read the swimming list again. You'll be fine.
Yeah, let's talk about the urine in the pool. That'll be just, that's just fine. That's just fine. But it's that on Father's Day. And the other thing that we were talking about as a family at the table is, you know, I took everybody up to Wisconsin. That was my gift. And I really think that, You know, the neckties, the coffee mugs, the gift cards, all the standard booze, wine, chocolate, the latest gadget. You know what? My dad is a guy that I think, you know, and he'll tell you, you know, I've got everything I need. You know, I don't need anything right mm-hmm. now. I think giving the gift of an experience and doing something together is so hugely important, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
You know, I mean, it brings family together. It allows people to have time together. Like, you know, we don't always see my parents. And so be able to say, you know what, for Father's Day, we're going to go to a Cubs game and we're going to go to dinner afterwards. We're going to go just take a walk in the park.
We did.
We took him to a Cubs game. But this time was just let's drive up to Wisconsin. And, you know, he bought lunch. I bought dinner, you know, that type mm-hmm. of thing. And I think life is a lot more about experiences these days. Do you really have to wrap a gift? Is it really important to hand somebody something? Do you really got to write somebody a check? Or can you just spend some extra time with that person? I think that's hugely important.
Sure, and it's always something like, you know, I got your coffee cup last year. I'll get you another coffee cup now. And you end up with boxes and boxes of coffee cups. And you know, those end up out on the, you know, $1 table.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true.
And they're gone eventually. And what I do have one coffee mug that our daughter got for me at a very early, because there's 10 years between our kids.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So she got a coffee mug, just says Dad on it. It's got like a old car or something.
Mm-hmm.
And the handle is broken off several times and glued back on, and now it's missing. I lost it years ago. But that's my...
That means something. I get it.
It means a lot because I use it every day for my espresso.
Yeah.
My double espresso mug every morning. So I'm always using it. And that means a lot to me. The 50,000 mugs I've gotten since then, not so much.
But that's what I'm talking about. Like those first mugs when the kids were little.
Right.
Now, how old are your kids?
Daughter's 37, son's 27.
Okay, so
they'll be 38 and 28 this year.
So they're out doing their own thing.
Oh yeah, and she's got two kids of her own. She's out on her own.
How special is that time you spend with them?
Oh, it's very special.
I mean, that's more important than anything when you know they're coming over. You're going out to dinner or hanging out at the house watching a movie or watching the grandkids. I mean, that's important.
In fact, they're mad at me because I'm working all day today.
Oh,
I come back from my afternoon shift, so I'm working or I'm sleeping.
Sure.
And so they're mad at me because, you know, we wanted to do something today for you. I go, you know what? Let me sleep. That would be doing something for me, you know. I'm okay with that. It's, after a while, I guess it's, I'm not a big holiday guy anyway.
Yeah, okay.
You know what I'm saying? Okay. It's because there's so much you got to do and the running around and the planning and the this and the that. And it's like, I'm just happy to be alive.
There you go.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm happy that they're here.
Yeah.
And I'm happy we're able to enjoy time together. Every day is Father's Day.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned. So, that's how I approach it.
Let me tell you, the best parts of the weekend for us, Josh, I'm going to say is, with my own father was sitting in the backyard. We grilled. So the place has a grill there. So we did do one tonight, actually. Last night we grilled. And my dad and I just, while the kids were in the pool, my mom and my sister and my wife were inside the room just pulling some stuff together. It was very throwback that we were all standing outside. And my dad and I were having an old style, sitting on the back patio and talking a little bit while we were grilling up some brats and stuff. And for Josh, you and I, playing cards at the table at the restaurant and fishing. We got back and we fished. Mm-hmm. Last night. Now, he got up. Listen to this guy. He gets up at 4:45 in the morning with his cousin to go out and fish after going to bed at about 1:30, and then all day long tubed, fished some more, swam, and then slept for 2 hours, and now here he is all night with us.
To be young again.
So was that Josh?
He's probably thinking, I could have done more. Why did I sleep 2 hours? I got things to do.
But here's the one thing that we're gonna have him do tonight, and Roger so kind of let him do that, is, he's, what's the broadcast group here? He's at Notre Dame High School. What's the broadcast group you're part of?
Media crew.
It's the media crew. So what do you do with the media crew?
Well, there's every morning between my first A period and my B period, I go down to the media room, which is this little classroom, probably half the size of the studio. And every day there's a different job for everyone. You could be a producer. You could be an intern for the producer. You could do the camera. You could do auxiliary. You could do the teleprompter, which is like two iPads that mirror off of each other with a camera going through.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And these are announcements that are like 15, 20 minutes long.
By the way, I know you saw this. Joey holds up cue cards for me. He's got about 300 of them for the whole show.
And that's awesome.
He's dropped them twice, and it's kind of screwed me up a little bit. But I prefer handmade.
Joey, tip, number them.
Yeah, good tip. That's a good tip. That's a good tip. But you do announcements and stuff, and it's certainly not like being on a 50,000-watt station, but where he's going to do the sports casts throughout the morning. So.
Yeah.
What's nice is he shadowed Kevin Powell on the Rokan show on Thursday of this week. And then Sam Panionovich, who was so kind to do this, when he was done with the beat and after he was done covering the Cubs game, went home and typed up Josh's report. Josh adjusted a little bit to his, wording and all that good stuff. But how nice that he did that for Josh.
Be great.
So, nice people. I love the people.
Now,
they're always fabulous.
Josh, wait for the big introduction, okay? Don't rush. Wait for the big introduction.
He'll do that when we come back. Absolutely. So here's what we got on the show tonight. Very excited about this. Comedian, writer, producer, now singer, and this blows me away, Seth MacFarlane from Family Guy is going to join us. He's going to be at Ravinia this Wednesday night, and he sings the classics. He, literally sings Sinatra and the classics from the Great American Songbook. Incredibly talented guy, and he's got some great stories to share. And we're gonna have him right after the news here. And, of course, the upcoming season is the 15th season of Family Guy. And, Josh, you're a big fan of Family Guy.
Oh, yeah.
See, now, do you watch it, Joey, too? You're a Family Guy guy? Are you, Roger, are you a big
fan? Yes, sir.
I as I'm flipping stations around, I'll hit on it, and maybe something I catch like a phrase or
man.
A bit or something. I go,
it's outrageous!
That's kinda...
It's outrageous.
And then as I watch it for a few more minutes, I'm going, "Why am I watching?" I just, oh, good Lord!
It's made for Josh. I think. Josh and Joey, exactly. Andrew Zimmern from the Travel Channel's Bizarre Foods. If you've ever seen that show, great show. He's going to talk about dusting off his passport to crisscross the globe in search of the world's most unusual food. So we'll do that. Then we're going to talk about TV's favorite dads. And Joey's pulled a ton of clips for us. And we're going to open the phone lines, too, to you folks out there when we talk about TV's favorite dads. Is it Howard Cunningham? Is it Andy Taylor? Is it Mike Brady? Cliff Huxtable? Phil Dunphy from Modern Family? We're going to talk about that as well. Then Steve Darnell is going to join us from Nostalgia Digest magazine about his summer edition. We're going to talk about the legendary team of Burns and Allen and the future of the history and future of the automat. Do you know what the automat is?
Sure. I know. It was real big in New York.
Yeah, big
you
in New York.
You walk around, you have little windowed containers or shelves with latch, and you put your money, you see something you want to buy, some food, you put your money in, you open it up, you take it out, put it on your train, you keep going down, you got entrees and stuff. And they even used to have coin machines in cafeterias where you could do that. And that's another thing, kind of like swimming pools, you know, where you look at what's there and you go, yeah, that's been there too long, and I'm not going to put my money in there, and you go away hungry.
The gravy's got a film on it.
We're gonna take a pass on that. Shines.
Well, let me tell you,
at you,
automats are in his magazine, and they're coming back. So we're going to about that. Oh yeah, they're coming back. Then at 4, we're going to talk to award-winning journalist and biographer Joshua Kendall about parenting and politics from George Washington to Barack Obama in his new book First Dads, which is perfect for Father's Day. Dave Schwein will join us later. Walter Jacobson too, and all kinds of good stuff with Seth MacFarlane and Josh Doing Sports coming up next on 720 WGN.
And let's check WGN Sports with Josh Plyer.
John Lester won his fifth straight start as the Cubs held on to beat the Pirates 4-3 at Wrigley. Anthony Rizzo, Chris Bryant, and David Ross homered in the win. James Shields continues to struggle for the Southsiders. Shields never made it out of the second inning. The Indians clobbered the White Sox 13-2. Game 7 of the NBA Finals tonight. It's Cleveland at Golden State for all the marbles out in California. Shane Lowry leads at the U.S. Open at 5 shots under, and the Fire lost 2-1 at Colorado. Josh Plyer, WGN Sports.
Boy, am I beat.
Peter, what's with the tie?
Oh, I bought a tie so I can loosen it when I'm beat.
Oh, my God, Dad!
Peter, your breath, it's horrible.
Is Whoopi Goldberg working out down there?
Peter, I think what everyone's saying is that you've got dad breath.
What the hell's dad breath?
You know, dad breath. Guys get older, they stop paying attention to hygiene, their bodies are changing. It's just a fact that at a certain age, men start to rot from the inside out.
How lucky can one guy be? I kissed her and she kissed me. Like the fella once said.
It's Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. We're all used to seeing writer, producer, filmmaker, actor, and singer Seth MacFarlane voicing the musical numbers on the hit series Family Guy, which has been nominated for 13 Emmy Awards, 5 wins, and will debut the 15th season this fall. But this overachiever also garnered 4 Grammy nominations, 2 for Family Guy and 2 for traditional pop vocal albums he released 5 years ago and last fall, and even a Best Song Oscar nomination for his theatrical hit Ted. Now, Seth is currently on tour performing with symphony orchestras across the country, singing the classics, numbers associated with Frank Sinatra and other notable vocal artists who left their mark on the Great American Songbook. And he's coming into Chicago this Wednesday, June 22nd, to Ravinia for an evening of music. And to talk about it all is Seth MacFarlane. Seth, good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Man, I got to tell you, I saw you perform and sing at the Oscars in 2013, which just amazed me. The depth of your talent just has no boundaries.
Well, that's I'm not a very good tennis player, so there are limitations.
Okay. You know, I saw you perform with the Chicago Symphony at Ravinia. When did singing become a part of who you are? Did you have any formal training? Like, how did that all come about?
You know, I think it was a combination of the fact that my parents were both very, very musical. They encouraged my sister and I to you know, do shows when we were younger, to join, believe it or not, a church choir. Coming from me, it was something that was always encouraged and always they felt it was an important part of the formative years of the brain. And I think it also had something to do with the fact that I desperately needed glasses, and I couldn't see a damn thing when I was a kid. So I used to sit in front of the record player, and nobody could figure out why the hell I wasn't interested in anything else. And then some genius figured out, oh, he can't see a damn thing, so let's get him some glasses. So I think it may have been that my auditory reflexes developed a little faster.
Interesting.
And drew me further into that field. But it really, above all else, has to do with my parents introducing my sister and I to the classics, to the Great American Songbook, to all the old great shows, you know, Rodgers and Hammerstein and Lerner and Lowe and whatnot, when we were very young.
And, you know, there's not a lot of people that are singing those songs anymore, so it's great to have them back and to have such a notable personality like you bring them to the forefront. And I know, you know, you did some training, and there was an older couple that worked with Sinatra and Streisand that you tapped to help you as well. Tell me a little bit about them.
There, yeah, Lee and Sally Sweetland, who I trained with for 10 years. I mean, they were both in their early 90s when I started training with them, and had both been married. They'd been married to each other since 1939, and both passed away just in the past couple of years, and trained people right up until they passed away. But they were both accomplished singers in the 30s and 40s. He was an opera singer. He had his own show on ABC Radio, and she sang on a lot of those old Henry Mancini choral mm-hmm. recordings and whatnot. And they're you know, they really trained the old-fashioned way. If you're getting up to the microphone with no electronic help, or if you're in the recording studio and it's all live, it's all raw, that's what they trained you to do. So it was extremely valuable to me, particularly for the live performances, because they really showed me how to build that muscle and how yeah. to just get up there and do it.
How cool is that? And I know you play a little bit too. Now I was taught piano by a nun who would slam a ruler seriously on the top yeah. of my knuckles if they weren't sitting up straight.
Anything taught by a nun, there's going to be some pain.
There's going to be some pain in here.
You better get it right if it's being taught by a nun.
Yeah, you're totally right. You're totally right. But I know you were 9 or 10 when you took piano lessons, and I heard you tell the story on the Daily Show with Jon Stewart. I mean, you had a teacher that was keeping you on your toes, too.
Yeah, I my piano teacher used to jab me in the head with a pencil. It wasn't the pointy end, which I guess is what yeah. kept her out of prison, but she... when you'd screw up, she would, like, grind the eraser end of a pencil into the top of your head, which
yeah.
I think probably wouldn't really fare so well nowadays.
It could leave a mark.
Changed culture.
It could leave a mark, yeah.
yeah.
Now, you recorded
Yeah, that's all there is to that story. That's
no, that was awesome. And you recorded your first album, Music is Better Than Words, with a microphone Sinatra used. Now, how's that for inspiration?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting. It was it's a very specific sound. It's an old mic, and it was I think it was being housed at Capitol Records in Los Angeles.
And that's pretty cool.
Yeah, the thing was about 50 years old, and we used it to record the whole record in the same studio where Sinatra recorded a lot of his records, and it is interesting. Each studio in Los Angeles or anywhere, I guess, has its own sound, and there are arrangers. You know, my arranger Joel McNeely, who I've done three albums with, is pretty good at hearing a recording and being able to tell you, oh, okay, that was recorded at Sony, that was recorded at Warner Brothers, that was recorded at 20th Century Fox. So each of these rooms has a very specific sound, and you know, I guess it's the same with microphones, because that was a very dark, kind of misty sound that worked really great for the record.
I know you've looked up to Sinatra, and of course Nelson Riddle, you know, arranged all of his songs. I know the arrangements are so important to you when you're performing. What other singers have had a strong influence on you?
You know, I mean, you're correct. For me, it really is all about the orchestration. If there's a great orchestration in the mix, then I just perform better, and particularly when you have a full orchestra. Nelson Riddle obviously was
sure,
as good as it gets. But you know, as far as other vocalists, I mean, Gordon McRae was a big influence because of the size of his voice, and I mean, that guy had, you know, he was in Oklahoma and Carousel, the feature film versions, and just had this the power of this voice. I mean, the guy could go out drinking all night, come in the next morning and record, and his voice just never failed him.
It's awesome.
Just an amazing instrument. And, you know, really, for me, the one guy who kind of comes up to Sinatra's level from time to time. You know, that's that, if I had to pick one other vocalist who really influenced me, it would be him.
Now, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, Seth, he's involved in so much other things and so much comedy on television and the movies and everything else. He really doesn't need this. But this isn't about needing this. This is about wanting to do this. You really enjoy yourself on stage.
Yeah, I mean, I love the singing. What I really love is orchestras. I mean, my favorite part of of any Family Guy episode or a film that I'm directing is that scoring session where you get to go in and hear the score played live with a full symphony orchestra. And that's more than anything what it's about for me. You know, I've collected these old orchestrations and also performed some new ones written by several arrangers that I've worked with. And there's really nothing like it. You know, when you're up there with just being enveloped by a band of 60 to 80 players,
yeah.
It's as much a concert for me as it is for the people in the audience, because half the reason I do it is just to hear the ensemble.
Well, and you play with all these local symphonies. You know, do you get some time to spend with them really before you hit the stage? Is it just rehearsal that day, the day before? I mean, how do you get in sync with everybody?
It depends. I mean, it is generally you get. It's usually the day of. Ideally, it's the day before because you get a chance to rest your voice. But I mean, you get maybe 3 hours tops to rehearse a 2-hour show, and so everyone really has to be on their game, and they are. I mean, you know, these local symphonies are fantastic. So it's a very doable thing, but it's a lot to cram in there, and you know, if you're rehearsing on the day and you're rehearsing a 2-hour show and then performing a 2-hour show, you know, I can't really do that twice in a day, or I'll just blow out my voice. So I just kind of whistle my way through the rehearsal, and then,
gotcha.
And then do the, you know, save it all up for the show.
Now I have to assume too that you're going to throw a little. There's a little bit of your sense of humor, of course, in this too, because people when they come to see Seth, they know they're going to see a musical performance, something unique, something different. But there's got to be some comedy infused in here too, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's always a lot of that in between the songs. I mean, I'm very aware that it's a segmented audience that is comprised of people who are there to hear the music, they're there to hear the orchestrations, and there are people who are there because they're fans of Ted or Family Guy or whatever.
Absolutely.
So it is this Goldilocks zone that I try to exist in when I'm up there, and we've honed it pretty well at this point. We've done now maybe about, God, over 20 of these things, and across the country, and so it's and around the world, and it's gotten to be a pretty easy rhythm.
Well, you can see Seth this Wednesday at Ravinia along with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra with special guest Catherine McPhee. For tickets, you can visit ravinia.org. And, of course, you can follow Seth on Facebook and Twitter. Thrilled talking to you. Thanks for taking a little time for us.
Thanks so much.
We'll see you in town this week.
Terrific.
All right, Andrew Zimmern from Bizarre Foods joins us next on 720 WGN. All right, Dave and Josh Plyer back with you here on 720 WGN. So I love Seth MacFarlane, but it's one of those things where he, you know, you talk to publicists a lot with all of these things, and they said, well, he wants to talk about his music. You know, he wants a place to talk about his music. And I said, well, who else is he talking to? And I love this, Roger, because you know I pride myself in some of this stuff.
Yeah, I know.
He doesn't do a lot of radio. He did an NPR interview about 6 years ago. He doesn't do radio. So he said, well, he'll talk to you, Dave, but he wants to talk about music, if that's okay. And I said, okay.
All right.
But now we'll have to talk about Family Guy. What's your favorite episode, Josh? You have one?
I mean, there's a lot, but like a recent one I've watched was Pretoria, which is when Peter...
Who's Pretoria?
Pretoria is what Peter names his land, so to say. His house wasn't registered.
Pretoria?
Yeah, Pretoria.
Is it Pretoria or Pretoria? Because wasn't that a Smothers Brothers thing, Roger?
Yeah.
We're marching to Pretoria.
To Pretoria, yeah. To Pretoria, to Pretoria.
Exactly. Yeah. Today, exactly.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, that was on the Purple Onion album.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
So, like, it goes on where he's, like, there's stuff wrong with his house, and he's, like, trying to look at the house in the market, and he's looking at his house, and it's not registered. It's just a black spot. There's no number on it. There's no address.
Okay.
And he raises a flag. He's not part of America. He's part of Pretoria. He's got the military on him because he can't leave his house. He doesn't have electricity. He doesn't have anything. He tries to go to the grocery store, and he goes on U.S. territory without a passport and all this crazy stuff.
But you know my sense of humor. Because I don't watch it that often. I just don't watch it. I would enjoy the show probably because it's just irreverent and inappropriate.
And there's also Mayor West.
And Mayor West, which is Adam West, of course. Adam West
as
well.
A few episodes where he'll actually...
I love the Star Wars one.
Oh, see, okay.
Where they redid the Star Wars. And the one where he's digging the ancient Indian burial grounds, where he's got the skull from
an
ancient... Is that the same one?
Yeah, because they're digging for it. Oh, no,
okay.
Because then it mixes with like poltergeist and like, the whole house swallows up.
Yeah, he hits a golf ball through. Yeah.
He's like... That's
sickly hilarious.
You are way more hipper than me, Roger Badish.
Well, I told you, you know, I have a lot of time on my hand, and I keep hitting the flip, and I go, oh, this looks interesting. I go, oh, God, no.
Very funny. All right, Josh.
This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. It's 3, and here are the top stories with Roger Badish.
Dave Player back with you on 720 WGN. So three-time James Beard award-winning TV personality, chef, writer, and teacher Andrew Zimmern is universally regarded as one of the most versatile and knowledgeable personalities in the food world. As a creator, executive producer, and host of the Bizarre Foods franchise on the Travel Channel, Andrew has explored cultures in more than 150 countries, promoting impactful ways to think about, create, and live with food. A few years back, he got into the food truck business, and the 8th season of Bizarre Foods premieres this Tuesday, June 21st at 8 Central on the Travel Channel. And joining us to talk about the new season is Andrew Zimmern. What's up, my friend?
Hello, Dave.
Hello, sir.
Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I was saying to you before we got started, big fan of the show. Like, my kids absolutely love every adventure you go on.
How old are they?
They are 15, 11, and 3.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's a nice...
Well, the three-year-old and I have the same sort of maturity level and moral compass. I'm glad the older kids can relate.
Yeah, they can. They totally can. And you know what it kind of does? It kind of opens them up to try new things. Because if you're willing to do what you do, I think it makes it a lot easier for them to try new foods as well. It really does.
The place I hear this the most is in the supermarket. 2-3 times a week back home, I'll find myself pushing my cart through an aisle at the local grocery store, and there's always someone who comes up to me, a parent, sometimes with kid in cart, and said, you know, we DVR your shows and play the Andrew Zimmern game, which apparently has something to do with, if that guy can eat this, you can surely eat your peas.
I think you're right.
Which is wonderful, and just on that small legacy alone, I would be very, very content with where I've gotten. The great joy for me is the people who apply that same principle to other matters, because as much as it is that I'm a food guy, I could care less about the fact that the show is about food. I want to tell stories about culture. I use food as the prism through which I, you know, reveal nuances of color and light to people about those foods and about those cultures.
Well, you
but
know,
at the end of the day, all I really want to do is have people, you know, be more patient, more tolerant, and understanding. So if I can get someone to be interested in someone's food, maybe I can get them to be interested in some people. Sure. We have a problem liking other people in America. We like people's food before we like them.
Yeah,
so
it's absolutely true. Now, I've heard that at a very young age, you knew you wanted to somehow be part of the food and fine dining world. How did you kind of, why did you find interest?
It was one of those things where there was an internal, you know, spark inside of me that was always there. So when I first started traveling and eating with my parents at age 4, 5, 6, I was so clearly geeked out about it. My parents... there's a picture of me in my kitchen. I'm about 5 years old. I'm tearing apart some seafood soup that has big chunks of clams and mussels and squid and a lobster claw in it. And I'm making a mess. I'm sitting at the end of a table at a family event in our summer home growing up. It's 1966. I'm 5. And underneath it, it says future food star that my mother wrote, I guess, when I was about 3 years later when she had the thing framed.
Wow.
It fascinated me. You know, I begged my father to take me with him on weekend business trips to Europe so I could try the foods that I, you know, read about in cookbooks or see on TV in the early days of food television with Julia and Jacques and, you know, James Beard's short term on TV or, you know, Galloping Gourmet or whatever. I read cookbooks, you know, all my parents' cookbooks I'd read by the time I was 12 years old. And I begged my parents to let me cook in restaurants by the time I was 14. So it's always been a part of my life.
Well, and then fast forward a little bit, your first foray into national television, you were an in-house chef for HGTV. How did that all come about?
Well, there were a bunch, actually, for a couple specific shows, Rebecca's Garden and a show called Typical Mary Ellen, which may have been the worst, best show on TV. I think if you launched Typical Mary Ellen right now,
yeah.
I mean, just aired the program straight, but put it on Showtime and called it a comedy. people would say it was the most brilliant send-up of those types of shows.
Uh-huh.
But both shows were shot in the Twin Cities. They needed someone to do food tips on Typical Mary Ellen, and with Rebecca's Garden, she needed someone to cook some of the foods that were coming out of the, you know, the edible ones that were coming out of the garden on half of her episodes. And I started to build some tape and a little bit of a reputation. And I was doing live local news in the Twin Cities and just kept pushing that rock uphill and finally had the opportunity to pitch the show that I wanted to do to a bunch of networks. They all said no. And Travel Channel said yes. So here we are 13 years later.
Yeah, which amazes me. You know, I lived in Minneapolis in the late 80s, early 90s in Uptown, and I visit often. I visit a few times a year. I absolutely love the restaurant scene up there.
You know, it's, and I'll tell you, I don't know if you've been in the last year, but the quality of the cuisine keeps getting better and better and better and better every couple of months. The number of great chefs from other parts of the country who were born and raised in Minneapolis, worked there, left to learn more and have come back to open restaurants, keeps growing and growing. And it really has become a world-class food town. And I'm also thrilled from a culture standpoint a little deeper that, you know, when I moved to the Twin Cities, it represented nothing.
Yeah.
And the restaurants were terrible and people didn't even, you know, cook food that was, you know, came from ingredients that were around them. There was no such thing as a statewide consensus on food. You know, flash forward 25 years that I've lived there, you know, not only are all those things now the complete reverse, but we have a situation where LA and New York are now dying to cook what Middle America and the Northern Prairie states have been doing for over a century, putting up vegetables, pickling, pies. I mean, you name it, whatever has come from our part of the world is now sort of the hot culinary currency.
Now, what is a guilty pleasure for me when I come up there, and I usually come up there with a half-filled suitcase because I'm going to go shop at Byerly's because that is still one of my favorite little places to go get wild rice sausage and all these great spices.
Yeah.
That's just kind of a guilty pleasure for me. I love that place.
Well, send me an email. We'll ship it to you. I'll save you the gas.
Okay. All right. That sounds good. Now, your mantra's always been, if it looks good, eat it. Now, did that come by exploring all these cultural foods as you travel? I mean, did you just realize, look, I'm just going to dive in and do this? I mean, it sounds like it started at a pretty early age. And not only do you embrace the food, but as you said, you embrace the culture and, most important, the people. And I think that's what is most engaging when watching you, is the connection you make to the people who are hosting you.
Yeah, you know, the world is about people. It's not about food. And I guess the big shock for me as I was traveling and then coming home was realizing how much Americans inhaled other cultures simply through their food and cared nothing about the people who stood behind those tables.
Mm-hmm.
We like the music of certain countries, the art of certain countries, but we, you know, the jury is out on how we feel about the people. And I mean, just, you know, look at the the rancor and disruptive, divisive nature of our, you know, political process over the last year has revealed, and certainly the stories, you know, in over the last decade here in America has revealed a very strong feeling that, you know, of food we are happy to eat, of people we are suspicious. My experience on the road, going to 167 countries and spending literally four-fifths of my year abroad, is that people are the same everywhere. And so we try to show that in our program, you know, as often and everywhere as we can. If I could simply take a bite of a dish at the end of every act before we went to commercial, I would do it that way. It would make for crappy storytelling, but I'm obsessed with the people that we meet along the way. And I'm very glad that that lesson comes through.
It does.
You know, if you have a platform, especially one that's as big as international TV, our show airs in 70 countries, and you don't stand for something, I think you're wasting your opportunity.
Sure. Absolutely. And I do think what you said earlier about, you know, us accepting other cultures is a very big challenge for some people in this country. And seeing the show kind of opens that up a little bit.
It's pretty amazing. I shot a pilot a couple of days ago in Minneapolis for a new show I'm trying out on Travel Channel, and we went to an iftar, which is the meal at the end of a night during the Ramadan holy month, where Muslims will break the fast together. And we were doing it at a Somali restaurant in Minneapolis. And the Somali community in Minneapolis has been growing and been accepted, and first male Somali representative to our state house was elected a couple years ago. There's a young woman running for the state house this coming cycle. The community is really, really rocketing along. And then came the news story of 2 years ago that some young Somali men had left for the Middle East and had attempted to join ISIS and all this stuff. And the old cultural biases just come sailing through, almost like a gotcha moment.
Yeah.
And, you know, I sat there at this iftar talking to 200 Somalis and hanging out, and every single one of them was dealing with the same things I was doing. You know, what are your kids doing for the summer? Where are they going to school come September? You know, how do you be a better husband? How do you be a better employer or employee?
Just a basic human connection.
Local sports team. I'm just the same exact people we are. And, you know, to be able to have the privilege to tell those stories, and it's just, I'm so grateful for it, because I think the world needs to constantly be reminded of that.
Well, there's more with Andrew Zimmern of Bizarre Foods next on 720 WGN. Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. We're talking to Andrew Zimmer, host of Bizarre Foods on the Travel Channel, about the 8th season premiere that premieres this Tuesday night. So on the website, Andrew, they list the 10 most bizarre foods in the world. Which ones make your list?
Well, I'll just, the worst couple of foods on planet Earth are walnuts and oatmeal. Would that they just did not exist. I would be oh so much happier. followed by about 8 or 9 different fermented and rotted foods from around the world that are extremely difficult for me to tolerate. There's a bread in East Africa called Ethiopia, especially called Enset, which is they bury it underneath a palm tree and let it rot for 3 months before they bake the dough. And it becomes riddled with mold and bacterium. If you eat it after a month, it'll kill you. If you eat it after, if you bake it after 3 months, it's nutritious superfood, but all the rot and the stink is there. And a loaf of it, you know, seemingly would weigh a couple of ounces, but weighs about 300 pounds. It's so dense. Very, very difficult to eat. Fermented skate wing or
from,
other fermented uremic
Korea.
Fish.
Was that Korea?
Yeah. There's a classification of fish, certain types of sharks, skate, that all pee through their skin. And these animals have so much ureic acid in their flesh that they rot quicker than other fishes, and that rotten fish tastes worse than other rotten fishes. And I still can't handle most of that. I just
Hakarl in Iceland, is that one of them? Yeah, Hakarl.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's one of them. You know, if you slice it thin and you put it on a piece of buttered toast, you know, that's great. But, you know, your sock, if you slice it thin and put it on a piece of buttered toast, would be tolerable. And people tell me this all the time, and I'm like, well, that's really fine. That's great.
Yeah.
But go to the place in Bjarnhofen in Iceland where they've been making it for 400 years and have some crusty old Icelander hand you a big fatty chunk of it, and then you tell me how delicious it is.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're pretty brutally honest about these things when you're on the air, and I think you're very brave in what you do, but there's some things I know you've been pushed to the complete edge just by the look on your face.
Well, you know, I'd rather be a better guest than be rude to my host or hostess.
Right.
If I'm in a small little town in Central America and a farmer owns 3 pigs and 10 chickens, and he kills a pig and 4 chickens to make a meal for us, even if it tasted like an old sweater, I would thank him profusely and use my opportunity off camera away from him to, you know, I believe in servicing my audience and let them know how I really feel about something. But I believe in being a better guest.
Sure.
I see too many people on TV who are rude and insensitive to the people who are around them in foreign countries. And it shocks me. I take my diplomatic role very seriously in many cases, especially where we go. I'm the first American and for sure the first white American that many of these people meet or may ever meet. And I take that responsibility very seriously.
Here is one of the most unusual items I saw you talk about, and it was eat was horse rib and rectum sausage.
Oh, yeah, in Kazakhstan.
Yeah.
Delicious, though. There's the thick intestine that leads right up to the rectum of the horse is used, and they strip the rib meat off the horse's ribs and then use and sometimes leave the bone in there, although most people just use it as a poker, to shove that rib meat down into the casing.
So they're using the casing,
It's mixed with salt. It's mixed with salt and garlic, and then it's just left to air dry, and then typically smoked after it's fermented and dried a little bit for a couple of days. But it is delicious. The Central Asian cured meats are fantastic. You know, everyone loves the sausages and hams of Italy, France, Germany, and you know, England, all the other European countries, and you know, American hams from the Southeast, and on and on. But Chinese meat art and Central Asian meat art is almost ignored completely in this country, and it is just fantastic.
Well, and your travels continue. Season 8 premieres this Tuesday at 9 Central on the Travel Channel. What are we going to see this season?
I think it's Madrid first, but yeah, Madrid and Senegal, Cyprus and Sweden, the Bronx, and down east coastal North Carolina, and a host of other locations. Everyone always asks me what's new this season, and I say, well, you know, this go round, it's just better than ever. And people look at me and they say, well, how's that? And we literally spend our entire hiatus from shooting. We're always working on the show 12 months a year. But I spend the entire hiatus figuring out ways to make it better, whether it's with equipment, storytelling, videography, you know, maps, graphics, whatever we can do. We're still not there yet. I think I'll work on this thing for another 10 years and still not think I'm getting it right. But this season is going to be a rocket ship experience for our fans. And I think, having been on, you know, Travel Channel for now 10, 11 years, there's a whole host of new fans brought over, to the show as well. It's exciting.
Now, you also mentioned that you are debuting a new show, and it's going to be debuting in August, Andrew Zimmern's Driven by Food.
Yep.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, this is one that's, you know, I hate to use the cliche of more verite, but it is more reality than anything else. Our Bizarre Foods is a docu-follow reality show. We know a lot of what's going to happen as it's happening. With the or before it happens with with Driven by Food, I actually get off a plane, throw my bag in the back of a cab in 8 different cities around the world, and let the cab drivers take me where they think I should go.
Oh, that's cool. Oh, I like that.
It's remarkable. We learned very quickly that multiple cab drivers was the way to go on different days. And so in Berlin, for example, I have a very progressive cab driver from the West who's my age. And then we have an East German cab driver older than myself who, you know, still lives his life much in the way that he did 40 or 50 years ago, very simply, as if the extravagance of the West didn't exist. And the culture lessons, the laughs, I mean, it is unbelievable. My cabbie takes me to a public swimming pool, and we're having an unbelievable time, and I invite him to come to Minnesota and come to our country club. And he goes, country club, tell me how that works. And I told him, I said, someone calls you by name, they seat you down, they put towels down for you, and then attractive young people bring you drinks and food until you can't anymore. And he just looked at me, and he's like, no. And he just starts laughing. And in the show, I mean, he refuses to believe that this actually exists.
That's awesome.
It was one of the funniest, greatest moments. It really is a superb show. The only female cab driver in Bangkok,
wow,
who is, you know, really fighting an uphill battle for women's rights, takes us around. And we just have an amazing, amazing show in Driven by Food. I think people are going to really like this season of Bizarre Foods. I think they're going to be blown away by Driven by Food come August 16th.
But you know what? It's funny. People talk about reality programming all the time, and half of the stuff is scripted, somewhat scripted. I really do feel when I watch your shows that I'm getting the real thing.
We don't script anything in Bizarre Foods. As a matter of fact, it's funny. Guests on the set wonder what I'm doing sitting in the car when we arrive at a restaurant or, you know, mm-hmm, in the tribal world somewhere out in the bush. I will wait until cameras are rolling and everything is. I don't even like to meet the people before we do our thing, because I want everything to. And we don't pre-script anything. Obviously, we know where we're going, and we have arrangements to do certain things, to see certain things, because you can't just show up somewhere and ask them to have something on hand that takes 2 days to cook. There's not a rehearsed moment. And when people ask me what am I proudest of with Bizarre Foods, it's that we've never faked anything in the history of the show.
Yeah, it shows.
I'm very proud of that.
Yeah, it absolutely shows. And new episodes of Bizarre Foods again begins this Tuesday at 8 Central on the Travel Channel. Driven by Food premieres in August. And for all of that and more information, you can visit TravelChannel.com. And for more on Andrew, visit AndrewZimmern.com. Got a lot of great goodies on your website as well. Andrew,
It's a great website. We got nominated for a Beard Award this year for the website. I was very proud of that.
Very cool, and congratulations on that as well. And happy Father's Day.
Thank you.
All right, it's Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. You know what that song means. My buddy Steve Darnall is here. You know, and he discovered the golden age of radio at the age of 12 while listening to Chuck Shaden's Those Were the Days weekly show, looking back at the simpler times, the happy days, the golden years of old-time radio and beyond. And now it's Steve's show, of course, for the last, how many years, Steve? It's been forever. It's been 7 years already. Look at that. Holy
I'm as surprised smart. As you are.
It's 7 years already. And joining me tonight to talk about the summer edition of Nostalgia Digest magazine, which includes tremendous stories about the legacy of George Burns and Gracie Allen, the history of the Automat. Automats are coming back, by the way. The Gentle Gangster, Edward G. Robinson, and so much more, Steve Darnall. Steve, hello, buddy.
Good morning, David.
What's happening?
Oh, not much, you know, just as you say, publishing the magazine, doing the show.
It is my favorite. I always say this when you're on, that when it comes in the mail, reminds me of the 1970s when the TV guide would come and I'd get to see what was going on and what's the next episode of my favorite show. And
thanks to Guy Lombardo, you kind of know how every song is going to end.
True.
I mean, literally in Guy Lombardo's case, because it's going to be bumped, bumped, bump, bump.
Right, yeah.
But Burns and Allen, I think, one of the things that was wonderful about them is that they were on radio for 18 years, but one of the things that when they went to television, I actually think it's one of the few shows that improved. And that's no offense to the radio world. But part of the magic of seeing Burns and Allen on television to me is that you get to see everyone react to Gracie Allen. And so, you know, on radio, she was very good at the sort of, oh, she means to be complimentary, but she's actually insulting George.
Yes, exactly.
But on TV, it was just sort of like you could see her do the illogical things, you know, like move this item to the stove when it should be in the refrigerator.
Was that the movies, you think, that kind of gave them that little insight before they got onto television?
Could be. Had a little... And, of course, you know, on stage as well, I think when George was in vaudeville, I think the big joke used to be that, you know, for extra comedic effect, he'd take an extra puff on his cigar, you know.
That's very true.
So you learned those things. And, of course, the fact that the TV show had George as the host, like in Our Town.
Right,
you know?
In front of the stage, in front of the curtain.
Right, narrating the action.
Now, there was this the movie, The Big Broadcast, with Bing Crosby.
Yes.
And they played a role in here, but this clip that you provided really does show that chemistry that they've always had.
Yes. I mean, the movie stuff they did in the 1930s was very much an extension of their vaudeville time when they were still doing the, quote, boy-girl act.
Yeah.
They weren't yet playing a married couple. But this is a real document of what it was like probably to see them in vaudeville.
Gracie, if anybody calls for me, I'm out.
Yeah. Oh, Mr. Burns, what's the matter? You don't look good.
I don't feel good.
Oh, maybe that's why you don't look good.
Well, sure. If you look good, then you feel good.
Oh, sure. And if you feel good, you look good.
Gracie, if anybody calls for me, I'm out. I'm not in. I'm not coming back. I'm closing up. I haven't any money.
Oh, Mr. Burns, why don't you go in business with my brother?
Which one, the halfwit?
No, the older one.
Oh, the, you know, the big fellow.
Yes.
What does your brother do?
Well, he's making money.
I mean, doing what?
Well, he's in the manufacturing business. He manufactures money.
Why, they make money in Washington.
Well, that's why he has his factory in Cleveland.
Your brother is a counterfeiter. He's a cheat, an embezzler, a forger.
Oh, Mr. Burns, if you're going to start using a dialect, nobody will understand you.
A dialect? Gracie, if anybody calls for me, I'm out.
And my brother isn't going to make that old-fashioned money either.
Gracie, if anybody calls for me...
Now, here's my brother's pennies. It's going to cost my brother 4 cents to manufacture every penny.
4 cents?
Yeah.
And that way, he's only making 3 cents profit.
Yeah, well, you must admit, that's not bad for a start, is it?
Listen, if anybody calls for me...
And my brother's nickels. They're not just nickels. My brother's nickels, you open up, and there's a powder puff inside.
You open up, and there's...
Yeah.
And that way, he's killing two birds with one stone.
Oh, that's very good. But I like the one about early to bed, early to rise makes you healthy, wealthy, and wealthy and healthy.
And healthy.
And wealthy.
Thanks very much.
Yeah.
That's awesome. That's awesome. But that really does, I guess, establish really how they got started. I mean, that's their...
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a real document, I think, into what it would have been like to see them in vaudeville in the 20s and 30s. And once you establish the character of Gracie Allen, you pretty much could plug anything into it. That was
so focused on Gracie, and then it became the Burns and Allen Show in 1936, aired through May of 1950, bounced back and forth from NBC to CBS, which is kind of odd, you know, for that day, wasn't it?
I guess. I think because the shows were sponsor-driven in those days, it was sort of like if Swan Soap had CBS, then that's where you went, and if Maxwell House Toffee had NBC, you went there.
Gotcha. And they had several regulars on radio, Toby Reed, Gail Gordon, B. Benaderet. I mean,
B. Benaderet, of course, his neighbor Blanche Morton, the great Bill Goodwin, who was the announcer for so many years, and Harry Von Zell, who, of course, went into the television show as well.
And then you've got another great clip, and how timely during this election year, and it's Gracie running for president.
Yes, in 1940.
Very cool. Let's take a listen.
I just sent a telegram to my campaign chairman in the Middle West.
Oh, good.
He told me he couldn't get any support from the Farm Belt.
So what?
So I told him to wear suspenders.
What happens if the county seat has two pairs of pants?
Oh, George, you're just trying to say, to make me say silly things so people will laugh at me.
That's bad, huh?
Say, Gracie, what's going to be the name of your party?
Well, Truman, you've heard of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party.
Yes.
Well, mine's going to be the Surprise Party.
The what?
The Surprise Party. Surprise. S-U-R-P-R-I-S-E.
Yeah, S for screwy, U for useless.
Yeah, and R for reading, writing, and arithmetic.
P for pinhead.
Yeah, and R for oysters are in season. an eye, an eye for an eye.
A tooth for a tooth.
An S for some fun, and E for pencils.
E for pencils?
Ever sharp?
Well, that old pencil on how you look at
it. Oh,
the
speaking pages.
Man, that's right in the audience.
Hey, this prize part is a swell name, I think. How'd you happen to call it that, Gracie?
Well, my daddy is a Democrat, and my mother is a Republican. And when I was born, I was a surprise.
That's awesome. I love that. You know, just to let those breathe a little bit and listen to those. Oh, those they're fantastic. Yes. Roger, you're a fan of Burns and Allen, too, aren't you, buddy? All right, Roger's taking a nap.
Back in the days when it was the idea of a media figure running for president was comical.
Yeah, I absolutely. I'm sorry, I'm watching Roger doze off. All right, so wow.
I am a pretty compelling speaker, you have to admit, David.
So let me tell you. The radio show of Burns and Allen, over 500 episodes, 16 years, something like that.
The way radio worked. You do 30 or 40 shows a year. You know, think of all these people nowadays and the sitcoms or whatever. They do maybe 20, 25 shows, but yeah, they were on 3/4 of the year with new material.
16 years, and then in 1950, transitioned to television, George Burns' Gracie Allen Show, immediate success.
Yep.
Through 58 on CBS. Initially was live in New York, presented every other week, and then it became a weekly series. Another 291 episodes. And I have to imagine a lot of these early shows grabbed stuff from the radio scripts.
I don't know. They very likely did. Yeah. And I mean, you know, it's one of those things. It's like Jack Benny's cheap jokes. I think once you've found the persona to plug into, I would guess it's fairly easy to write jokes for a character like Gracie Allen.
Now, here's the one thing. They won 11 Primetime Emmy Awards, Burns and Allen. There were really no radio awards, were there, back in the day?
Nothing like the Emmys or the Tonys.
No, like that? Okay.
You know, there were ratings, and there were certainly magazines would bestow awards upon shows, but
nothing really.
Nothing in the
like
sense
that.
Where everybody in radio got together for a banquet.
You still have a great item that you sell on your website that was done in the 1970s. It might have been a PBS special. What was that special? That
yes, the good old days of radio.
Oh my God, that is one of the coolest things on the planet to see all these people gather in one room, because really they were gone within a few years after.
No, in 1976, PBS did this show. Steve Allen hosted, and as you say, all these radio veterans were there, many of them 60, 70, 80 years old. And of course, that was 40 years ago. So,
but to hear them, to see them, to put names and faces,
absolutely.
It's a great piece, and you can get that at nostalgiadigest.com. Now, George died in 96 at the age of 100, 32 years after Gracie. You know, she was sick. She had heart issues and so forth. 1964, he lived that long beyond his wife.
Yes, and as you know, he kept very busy.
He did. Absolutely. Absolutely did. Well, I'll tell you what, there's more with Steve Darnell in Nostalgia Digest magazine, and we'll do that next on 720 WGN.
Soon we'll turn the corner with our banners flying high.
So let's have another cup of coffee.
And let's have another piece of pie.
Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. We're talking about the summer edition of Nostalgia Digest magazine with Steve Darnell.
Can I say, I love the idea that people are going to be walking by the Tribune Tower hearing that song coming out of the loudspeaker.
Isn't that funny?
That's brilliant.
But you know what? That song, though, that is very familiar, is all about the Automat, and great feature on that. And I didn't know enough. I didn't know really much about this at all. It's a great article.
Oh, thank you. Yes. We had a wonderful woman, Elsie Van Savage, who wrote a piece about eating at the Automat when she was a child. And of course, yes, she's a terrific writer, and it's a very evocative piece that tells you a lot about what the place was like.
Well, there were food dispensing machines. You'd kind of open the door, and I've seen some clips with, like, Audrey Meadows in some 1960s movie
like
in New
Touch
York.
Of Mink.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
No, you'd put in your nickel, open the door, you'd pull out your cup of coffee, and then someone behind on the other side would say, oh, put a cup of coffee in to replace that one.
Yeah, that's amazing to me. But here's the really cool part. Is that, you know, it would be like baked beans in a pot, beef stew, mac and cheese, mashed turnips.
Oh, sure. Apple pie, all those
mashed
things.
Mashed turnips. That just does not sound good, does it?
But not sitting in a drawer for a long time.
But they were very well known for their coffee, of course. Mm-hmm. But now they're talking about Automax making a comeback. There's a Pittsburgh company that's looking at bringing these things back, if you can believe that. Philadelphia.
I shouldn't be too surprised. You know, it's the sort of thing, it's all about convenience.
That's true.
And unusual experiences. And yes, I was thrilled too. We were able to get a great photo of the Horn and Hardart Automat.
Yeah, nicely done. Issue as well. Absolutely nicely done. Yeah, I heard the company has signed about 16 franchise agreements throughout the U.S., including New Jersey, Washington, D.C., Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Delaware. And there's someone that signed up for Florida. So they're going to try to kick these things off again.
I know there have been efforts to revive the Automat, yeah. So I wish them luck.
What else are we going to find in the summer edition, Steve?
The summer issue of Nostalgia Digest. Oh, gosh. Well, we have the Automat article. We have a great piece about songwriter Johnny Mercer, who wrote that old Black Magic and Accentuate the Positive. We have a great piece about Edward G. Robinson, who had an amazing life and career as a movie gangster and a lot of other things as well. We have an article about the Three Musketeers on film and the various efforts to succeed or fail. We have a conversation with Charlotte Ray, who was, of course, on The Facts of Life and Different Strokes.
Right.
But before that, she was a student at Northwestern University and a radio actress, I believe, in this very building.
That's wild.
Yeah. So wild. She talked a little bit about that and a few other things. Like I say, we've got an article about Cornell Wilde. We've got a great piece about memories of Friday night game night.
Oh, I love that.
You know? Yes, love which, of course, families still do today.
Absolutely. We were just talking about that board games are important to our family. Like, as much as people are playing Xbox and everything else and on their iPhones and their iPads and everything else, we love sitting down because it's a great communal experience.
Oh, yeah. Obviously. In fact, well, one of the things Jim Doran, the writer who wrote the piece, remembers finding these boxes years later, and it's like, wow, you can tell we were eating buttered popcorn and playing
game. Yeah, when you see the condition of the boxes. Oh,
exactly.
Absolutely. And you do appearances all around town all the time. What do you got coming up?
Well, we talk about the golden age of radio at Public, and this coming Tuesday night, June 21st at 7 p.m., I'll be at the Blue Island Public Library to talk about old-time radio. And then on June 30th at 7 p.m., I'm at the Arlington Heights Public Library to talk about comic book heroes who moved to radio.
Cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. How do we get a subscription to the magazine again?
Nostalgia Digest. Yeah. It's available in stores everywhere. Well, most everywhere. It's available at nostalgiadigest.com, or you can call our offices at 773-769-6575. Although if you call now, you'll get the machine.
But nostalgiadigest.com, you'll get all of that information.
Absolutely.
There as well. Stick around. We're gonna do a segment on great TV dads. Love to have you around for that if you want to stick around for another
10
or 15.
I am a great TV dad, so that will be perfect.
There you go. And I'll tell you what, if you've got a favorite TV dad, I want to hear what it is, folks. 312-981-7200. Call it, text it, your favorite TV dad of all time, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. And we'll do this after the news. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNradio.com. And look, we are on time. Roger Badish, it is 4 o'clock. I know, you're shocked. You're shocked, like I shocked you earlier. And here's the latest with Roger. All right, it's Dave and Josh Plyer on this Father's Day Sunday morning with you on 720 WGN. Steve Darnall, also from Nostalgia Digest magazine, hanging out. And today's Father's Day, it's a good time to step back and ponder the evolution of the role of fathers on television from the very beginnings of the small screen, of course, with Jim Anderson, Father Knows Best, Ward Cleaver, Leave It to Beaver, Mike Brady and the Brady Bunch, Howard Cunningham of Happy Days, Cliff Huxtable of The Cosby Show, Ray Barone of Everybody Loves Raymond, Phil Dunphy of ABC's Modern Family. Who is your favorite? 312-981-7200. We got a ton of texts coming in. We'll read those in a little bit. I'm going to start with you, Roger. Who's your favorite TV dad?
Well, I don't like dysfunctional families, so that cuts out a whole bunch of TV families.
And it cuts out yours and mine
and
everybody else in the room.
That's probably why I don't like it. But I'm going to throw one out that you didn't mention that I think you're going to be surprised at.
Okay.
And I think it has more to do with the actor who played it.
Oh, Fred Flintstone, yes. No, go ahead.
Yeah, but I'm
Fred Sanford.
No, I like Eddie's father.
Oh, The Courtship of Eddie's Father.
Yes, sir.
Love that.
That was a great show. I loved the relationship. Yeah. I loved his The Bill, attitude, his...
Bill
his,
Bixby and Brandon
yep,
Cruz.
That's
yeah.
right.
What was the housekeeper's
and,
name?
And, you know, I used to have it memorized, and now you're just going to... Of course you had to ask
me. Let me tell you about my best friend.
Da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Josh even sang
Harry Nielsen sang the theme song, right?
Is that right? Is that who it was?
Harry Nielsen sang the theme song.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Josh, what about you?
I don't know. We were talking about Family Guy. I don't think Peter Griffin would be a very good father. But
he's a role model for Josh. Modern society.
Josh is a great kid.
What would you say? I mean, go retro on me, because we watch retro stuff at the house. I'm sure you guys would imagine
I'd
that.
I'd say Happy Days, I think.
Howard Cunningham?
Howard Cunningham was...
Who would you say more contemporary?
Contemporary? Ooh.
You watch Modern Family, you watch The Middle. What,
yeah.
You
know, what I'd say... Well, Middle is, like, very patient-wise, but Modern Family, just as far as, like, a goofy kind of dad, kind
That's
of
true.
Fun.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah.
I got an Andy Griffith. I got an Opie's dad. I got Go Josh. You got a fan out there, Josh, Ooh. On that one as well. What about you, Steve?
Oh, I've always been fond of Andy Taylor.
Yeah.
You know?
Right? Yeah. Single dad.
Yeah. Lots of single dads on TV,
That's
of
true.
Course.
Yeah.
And, of course, like everybody else, I'm enchanted by Homer Simpson, but less as a father.
Of course. Of course.
You know, and, of course, interesting note that Father Knows Best actually started on radio. People don't all know
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no, that is a rare, that is a kind of an unusual little fact. All right, we're going to listen to, we've got 773 says Ward Cleaver. Here's a classic and very sexist statement from Ward Cleaver. Let's take a listen.
Just one?
Dad's funny.
What's funny?
Well, whenever we cook inside, Mom always says to cook it. But whenever we cook outside, you always do it. How come?
Well, it's sort of traditional, I guess. You know, they say a woman's place is in the home, and I suppose as long as she's in the home, she might as well be in the kitchen.
Oh, jeez.
Oh. Well, that explains about Mom. But how come you always do the outside cooking?
Well, I'll tell you, son. Women do all right when they have all the modern conveniences. Mm-hmm. But us men are better at this rugged type of outdoor cooking. Sort of a throwback to caveman days. And then those asbestos gloves, wouldn't you
mind? That's fantastic.
There's a regular Robert Bly, isn't he?
That is awesome. Joey, what about you? You got a favorite TV dad?
I guess if I go modern, I'm a big Phil Dunphy fan, which I know we may talk about later. Yeah, but Modern Family, just the way they've cast him is just so unlike any other dad on TV that it's a little more relatable because it's something new.
I got 847 says the dad from the Goldbergs, 815, the dad from Malcolm in the Middle, hardworking but still fun. Here's a bunch of other ones. Danny Williams from Make Room for Danny, Dan Connor of Roseanne, Stephen Keaton, Family Ties. And here's a Mike Brady from the Brady Bunch. Let's take a listen.
Listen, I predict Marcia's going to pass her driver's test with flying colors.
Right, and I predict that Jan's going to do just great in today's debate.
And I predict that you two are great predictors.
Hi, Alice.
Hi.
Now, remember what I said about psyching yourself up, Jan?
Yeah, but I'm still nervous.
Oh, relax, Jan. Women can't be great at everything, but they make wonderful debaters.
Wow. Some more sexist stuff on this Sunday morning. That's lovely.
I'll take any advice.
All right, so that's a little Mike Brady. Let's see here. I've got a Tim Taylor from Home Improvement. Herman Munster. He was a good dad, wasn't he? Exactly. What else you got there, Roger? You got something else on your mind? You're talking to David?
He's apologizing for being a little late. And I said, come on.
Martin Lane from Patty Duke just passed away also.
That's right.
Well,
we just lost him.
I never gave much thought to the dads on TV. I'd have to say the ones that kind of still stand out in my head might be Fred McMurray from My Three Sons.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But again, I'm going more with the actor. And some of the ones that stand out are these actors that really got to me. And I think the roles were written for their personality.
I think that's true.
You know what I'm saying?
Totally
as opposed
true.
To trying to fit them into something the writer wanted.
312 says Miyoshi Umeki was the housekeeper.
That's it.
Eddie's father.
She was in I think she might have been in Tea House of the August Moon and several other movies.
Yeah.
Josh would say Tony Soprano.
Tony Soprano was a fabulous father figure.
He really was. He really like
And he did love his kids. He did.
And I'm in terms of modern shows, personally, my tastes run to the characters that are more sort of peripheral fathers, like Ben Wyatt on Parks and Recreation.
Oh, yeah. Okay. You know, okay. All right. That's
probably
fair.
A great dad. But
then you have, and I got another one here from 630. You got the Waltons, John Walton, Charles Ingalls from Little House on the Prairie. So some of those are some.
I don't know about the
that
Waltons.
Goes back even before me.
You know why? Because it takes like an hour for everyone to go to sleep.
That's true.
You know, and if I was a dad, I'd just yell, everyone just shut up and go to sleep.
My
know?
Favorite, like Josh mentioned, is Howard Cunningham of Happy Days. And this is when, and believe me, I have a connection to this because I think when I was in high school, I came home after a few beers and my father really actually took care of me without my mother knowing. And this is one of those situations where Howard was talking to Richie after coming home from a bachelor party. Let's take a listen.
You're pretty sick, huh, son?
Well, it must have been something I ate. Probably the salami. You never know what they make salami out of, you know, Dad?
Yeah, that's true. Couldn't be that you had too much to drink now, could it?
Oh, that's silly. All we had was some beer and teeny-weeny glasses.
How many teeny-weeny glasses did you have?
72.
Classic. Absolutely classic. And then, of course, a couple of you mentioned Phil Dunphy from Modern Family. Let's take a listen to Phil.
I'm the cool dad. That's my thing. I'm hip. I surf the web. I text. LOL. Laugh out loud. OMG. Oh, my God. WTF. Why the face? You know, I know all the dances to High School Musical, so...
We're all in this together. Yes, we are. We're all stars. That means something, you know it.
I love that show, man. I got to tell you, Modern Family, it's one of the best shows on television still to this day. Ozzie Nelson, Rob Petrie. I got a Rob Petrie from the Dick Van Dyke show. I think that's a good
one. How about
one
Ben
well.
Cartwright?
Yeah, from Bonanza, right? Yeah. How about you, Ann? You got a favorite? You're on 720 WGN.
Oh, hi, good morning. Happy Father's Day to you all. I like The Life of Riley, William Bendix's show. I listened to the old radio shows, and I never liked him before, but I got used to him, and I kind of like him.
That's
Life of Riley.
And who was
William
it?
Bendix.
William Bendix.
William Bendix,
yeah.
Great actor. And
I think at some point, didn't Jackie Gleason play Life
the first
of...
season on television.
Okay,
yeah.
On television
and,
he did.
And
okay.
I guess Bendix was contractually unavailable. But no, William Bendix, great actor, and The Life of Riley's brilliant stuff.
I always liked Ozzie and Harriet from someone from Florida. Tom Bradford from Eight is Enough. That's 815 just coming in. Archie Bunker, All in the Ooh. Family, I would say, though.
Mr. Jetson.
I've got a list of a few. Mr. Jetson, Flintstones. Now, the worst dad list, Al Bundy, George Bluth from Arrested Development, Dexter from Dexter, Randy Marsh from South Park. Anybody know this character, Randy
Who,
Marsh?
Say it again?
Randy Marsh from South
oh,
Park.
Oh, South Park. I never watched the
Sopranos. Don Draper from Mad Men. Terrible dad. Now, see, you said Homer Simpson. He made the bad list here.
Oh, well, don't doubt it. He's a terrible father. But
all right, we're going to – those are your best
He's
TV
just a funny
dads.
One.
Thanks for joining us, Steve. Appreciate it, pal.
Thank you, David.
All right, we're going to talk about first dads, parenting, and politics from George Washington to Barack Obama next on 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. It's Dave Player back with you on 720 WGN. So every president has had some experience as a parent of these 43 men who have served in the nation's highest office. 38 have fathered biological children. The other 5 have adopted children. Each president's parenting style reveals much about his beliefs as well as his psychological makeup. And in the new book, First Dads, Parenting and Politics from George Washington to Barack Obama, author and biographer Joshua Kendall, you'll discover how the fathering experiences of our presidents have forever changed the course of American history. And the author joining us this morning is Joshua Kendall. Good morning, Joshua.
Good morning. Pleasure to be with you.
Thank you for being here as well. You know, I was looking at this. One of the worst things in the world is being the child of a president, FDR said to an aide in 1934. That's pretty telling.
Yeah, FDR was actually having a lot of trouble with his kids, so I think he was trying to make sense of it. And FDR was an amazing president, whether you're a Democrat or Republican. He was, you know, one of the most effective presidents of the 20th century and was very connected so well with the nation. But he had a lot of problems connecting with his kids. They had to make appointments to see him, and he was a very distant dad. So sometimes the public man is very different from the private man. And Ronald Reagan was the same way. Ronald Reagan was a very effective president. He was a great communicator with the nation, but he also had trouble connecting with his kids.
Well, as I say, you break down the book in six categories: the preoccupied, playful dads, double-dealing dads, tiger dads, the grief-stricken, and the nurturers. And, you know, you mentioned as FDR being those, you know, part of the preoccupied. George H.W. Bush was one of those people as well.
Yeah, George H.W. Bush was very ambitious. I mean, obviously, most people who become president are very ambitious. And he was, living in Houston and going back to Connecticut on business very often. And he often left the kids with family members or with friends. And Jeb Bush once said, geez, I'm glad that at least they didn't leave us in a kennel.
Oh, geez. That's crazy. Theodore Roosevelt, I think that's one of my favorite stories that you put in the book. You call him one of the silliest.
Yeah, Theodore Roosevelt loved to play tickly and grabby with his kids. He would sometimes stop work at 3 o'clock and hop into the attic of the White House and play tag with his kids. So he's one of the playful pals. Another one is Woodrow Wilson. We think of Woodrow Wilson as a very serious president. He was the only president with a PhD. He was the former president of Princeton. But he loved to dance, and he had three girls. And so he was playful, but in a different kind of way, playful with his girls, whereas Theodore Roosevelt was a man's man and loved to go hunting and fishing with his boys.
Well, you know, it's funny, when I read this book, there's certain personas you have and certain ideas you have about some of these presidents and what they're like behind the scenes. And in pretty much everything that I thought was absolutely incorrect because you just have these, they have these public personas. Like I wouldn't, you know, I know Ron Reagan had trouble with his, with the relationships with his kids, but you know, he never came off that way. You know, he came off somebody like you knew.
Yeah. There are some surprises. Sometimes the president is very much, the public man is very much like the private man, and that can be surprising too. John Adams was a very authoritarian president. He gave us the Alien and Sedition Acts in 1798. Journalists who opposed him could go to prison. But he also was one of these tiger dads and was very tough with his children, particularly his sons. And that was just a little bit hard to believe. He told his son, John Quincy, you're either going to be president or you're going to be a failure. John Quincy lived up to the challenge. And John Quincy Adams was also a tiger dad, just remarkably tough with his kid. As was Jimmy Carter. We think of Jimmy Carter as a kind of a peace-loving dad because, you know, of the Camp David Accords and his efforts on peacekeeping around the world. But he was a former military man from West Point, and he often treated particularly his sons. People forget that Jimmy Carter had three sons besides Amy. He treated his sons like military underlings and often just bossed them around.
Now you talk a little bit about some of the tragedies that happen from a parental perspective with Abraham Lincoln and Calvin Coolidge as well.
Yes, I have a chapter on grief-stricken dads. And grief-stricken dads actually affected this election, as I wrote in a piece for the New York Times in the fall. Joe Biden would have been running for president if he hadn't lost a kid.
Yeah.
Calvin Coolidge loses a 16-year-old son in 1924, just as he's gearing up for running on his own. And he's just devastated when he dies 9 years later. Dorothy Parker of The New Yorker famously notes, how could they tell? Because Coolidge just starts to sleep all the time. He sleeps 11 hours a day. He's really depressed. And before the death of his son, he's very energized. Lincoln loses a son in 1862, and these kinds of losses can either kind of destroy someone or they can help people sort of find something deep within. Lincoln loses his son in 1862, Willie, at the age of 11, and when he dies in 1865, he said, right before his death, he says, I thought about Willie every day for the rest of my presidency, but Lincoln becomes this amazing Civil War leader, and out of this pain comes a new mission and a new dedication to fighting the war and healing the country.
Well, just as you say that Abraham Lincoln, that it actually strengthened, you know, it made him stronger. You mentioned Calvin Coolidge, you know, that his depression might have helped cause the Great Depression. His eye wasn't on the ball.
Yeah. So, the losses can go either way. John Quincy Adams loses a son to suicide right after his presidency, and that also kind of energizes him in a strange way, because John Quincy Adams has his amazing second career as an abolitionist congressman, and he might not have had that had his eldest son, George Washington, not committed suicide in 1829.
Now, you say that there's a tie between those who you considered that were the worst dads in the Oval Office.
So the Tiger dads were the worst dads were maybe Adams. And Dwight Eisenhower was also not one of the best dads. He was very, very tough with his son, John, extremely critical. And the Tiger dads, they love their kids, but they're just Eisenhower had a bad temper, and he often kind of let loose on his kids, on his son, John. And you know, he'd apologize afterwards, but it kind of has an effect. And John said, well, I was born standing at attention. And whenever my father said to do something, I did it.
And there was a toss-up really between the two best, and let's go with the oldest, which would be Rutherford B. Hayes.
Yes, people don't remember him too well. He was president in 1876, but he's the guy behind the Easter egg roll at the White House. A neighborhood kid came up to him and said, sir, can we, you know, play on your lawn? And he said, sure. And today there are 30,000 kids who roll their egg on the lawn. And Hayes was just very sweet with his own children. And Harry Truman was sweet. His daughter, Margaret, calls him a total daddy's girl. And our current president is very connected to his girls. And he was just talking this week about, you know, concerns about their being safe in the wake of Orlando. And he's always reflecting on the world from his perspective as a father of two girls.
I have to ask you, any thoughts on where, and I kind of know where you're going to put them, but I'm going to ask you anyway, where you would put Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump in these categories?
Yeah, I think both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are, even though Hillary Clinton would be our first mom, she's kind of a preoccupied parent going back to FDR. I mean, she's a very serious woman who's been thinking about her career and all the time. And women of her generation who wanted to make it big in politics and the law had no choice but to sort of adopt male roles. And Donald Trump is also a preoccupied. And the Trump kids, like Chelsea Clinton, connect with their parents through work. The three Trump kids from his first marriage all are vice presidents of the Trump Organization, just like Chelsea Clinton is a vice chair of the Clinton Foundation. So they're entering their parents' world. Their parents' preoccupations become their preoccupations, as opposed to Obama, who seems to be more nurturing. And I think his elder daughter wants to become a filmmaker, and he's going to help her sort of find her own thing, whereas we're with preoccupied parents, the children often do enter into the parents' world and work with them.
Well, Joshua, I got to tell you, it is a terrific book. It's a fascinating read, and again, it surprised me in so many different angles. It's called First Dads, Parenting and Politics from George Washington to Barack Obama. If you haven't bought a Father's Day present yet, it's a great gift. You can get it at your local bookstore or, of course, at Amazon.com. Joshua, thank you so much for spending some time with us, and happy Father's Day to you as well.
Happy Father's Day to you, Dave, and it's nice to have been with you.
Thank you. All right, This Week in History coming up next on 720 WGN.
And now, once again with WGN Sports, Josh Plyer.
John Lester won his fifth straight start as the Cubs held on to beat the Pirates 4-3 at Wrigley. Anthony Rizzo, Chris Bryant, and David Ross homered in the win. James Shields continues to struggle for the Southsiders. Shields never made it out of the second inning. The Indians clobbered the White Sox 13-2. Game 7 of the NBA Finals tonight. It's Cleveland at Golden State for all the marbles out in California. Shane Lowry leads at the U.S. Open at 5 shots under. And the Fire lost 2-1 at Colorado. Josh Plyer, WGN Sports.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I love you.
All right, it's Dave Plyer and Josh Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. And now joining us in the chair, switching a roo, is Mr. Dave Schwann.
Well, good morning and happy Father's Day. Josh, take care of your dad today.
Thank you. I will.
Okay.
We're going to Polish Fest in Milwaukee.
That sounds wonderful.
Right?
That really does sound great.
Some good music, you know, some good classic. You know, I grew up with all that stuff, and then some good pierogies.
I was just going to say, pierogies, you got to have
my favorite pierogies sign, though,
and glumki.
My favorite sign, though, I swear, when you walk in, there's a big sign that says krautballs.
Oh, yeah.
What the hell is that? Yeah. Every time I see it, I take a picture like I'm five.
Krautballs?
So they're like deep fried balls of sauerkraut.
Ooh. Oh, man.
I want to try one, actually. That can't be bad.
Well, you're young. You can try one. It's not going to hurt you.
Yeah. Nice. You know, okay, there you go. The color in your studio, I'm just looking. If you're looking at WGNradio.com, for some reason, the color was red. It looked like there was like a,
I know.
Like there was a
I've
reaction.
I've noticed that myself.
Like there was like a nuclear reaction happening at your desk.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the deal is. Yeah.
The Banish effect. It's a switchover.
Exactly.
By the time I'm done, everything will be in black and white.
Did you get some coffee?
I did.
All right. Do you have a favorite TV dad?
I heard you guys talking about TV dads, and I guess I would have several. You know me. The television ended when they started shooting Andy Griffith episodes in color.
Yeah.
So,
right?
But no, Andy is one of my, I think as a father, as a single father, he was wonderful in there. And I heard, you know, going through a list of other TV dads, Fred McMurray, Robert Young, and Father Knows Best.
The classics. These are the classics.
Yeah. Dick Van Dyke as Richie's father.
I want to say Ricky Ricardo. If I'm going to throw him into this presidential conversation, he was a preoccupied father. He was always at the nightclub.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
Or dealing with his wife.
Yeah. Yeah.
What was that called? The club.
Tropicana.
Yeah. Babaloo.
Babaloo
was the song he did, but the club was the Tropicana.
No, but he was a Tropicana at the beginning, but then the last seasons he had his own club.
Okay.
See? Some worthless trivia for you, Dave.
I hadn't forgotten that. I heard somebody else mention Archie Bunker as a father. And, you know, we always think of him as the lovable grouch and everything else, but there was an episode where spacing her name now. His daughter.
Sally Struthers?
Sally, yeah.
Gloria?
Gloria, thank you. Was going to have a baby. She had become pregnant. And then she miscarried. And, of course, was devastated. And the final scene in that one show of Archie going into her room and comforting her was very touching.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It was also very touching when he took his own grandchild to be baptized when everyone told him not to. That makes him probably one of the worst as well. So that happens.
Yeah.
All right, we got some history here to talk about today. Let's talk first about 1868. President Andrew Johnson passed a law that government workers would work an eight-hour day.
Hmm.
So that was the first. So in 1864, an eight-hour day quickly became a central demand of the Chicago labor movement. The Illinois legislature passed a law in early 1867 granting an eight-hour day, but many loopholes made it largely ineffective. So there was a strike that began in Chicago in 1867 before our economy collapsed here. And then on June 25th, 1868, Congress passed an eight-hour law for federal employees, which also limited effectiveness as well. So, you know, they were working 12 hours a day.
Sure.
6 days a week.
And I think the five-day 40-hour work week, you know, 8 hours a day, Monday through Friday, didn't really happen until the early years of the 20th century.
That's true.
So, you know, you had the an 8 hour work day, but, you know, they could have stretched that over 6 days.
They could have. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. 1910 was the first Father's Day, Josh.
Father's Day celebrated for the first time at the YMCA in 1910 by Sonora Smart Dodd.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So who was born in Arkansas? Its first celebration was in the Spokane YMCA on June 19th, 1910. Her father, the Civil War veteran William Jackson Smart, was a single parent who raised his six children there. After hearing a sermon about Jarvis Mother's Day in 1909, she told her pastor that fathers should have a similar holiday honoring them.
Honoring, she initially suggested June 5th, her father's birthday. The pastors did not have enough time to prepare their sermons, and the celebration was deferred to the third Sunday of June.
So there you go, a little Father's Day history, or 1910.
Yeah, the person he refers to is Jarvis, Josh. That was Anna Jarvis in West Virginia, who word got around that she, you know, wanted to honor her mother, and Sonora Smart Dot in Spokane thought that was a good idea. Let's honor fathers as well. I think her father had recently passed away. So just to add to that, you had. You had all the facts right, though.
There you have it.
Good
there
work.
You have it. Thank you. 1917, Raggedy Ann doll was invented. Now, it's a character created by American writer Johnny Gruhl. In a series of books he wrote and illustrated for young children. It's a rag doll with red yarn for hair and a triangle nose. He created Raggedy Ann for his daughter Marcella when she brought him an old handmade rag doll, and he drew a face on it. From his bookshelf, he pulled a book of poems from James Whitcomb Riley and combined the names of the two poems, The Raggedy Man and Little Orphan Annie. And that's
Raggedy Ann.
There you go. Boom.
There was a Raggedy Ann food company. Do you remember that, Dave?
Yeah, I kind of do. What was it? Was it sweets or what was it?
It was kind of like Green Giant or you know, Libby's, where they would, you know, canned fruits and vegetables.
Yeah.
I don't think they've been around in years, but I remember seeing Raggedy Ann Foods in the store, canned goods,
sure,
you know, canned
sure.
beans or yep. Canned corn, and the logo featured the Raggedy Ann doll on the front of the product.
I'm sure there was money to be made there.
I would think so.
1933, Don McNeil's Pepper Pot, which was the Breakfast Club. Don McNeil's Breakfast Club began a 35-and-a-half-year run on NBC. The Breakfast Club is a long-run morning variety show on the NBC and ABC network originating in Chicago, hosted by Don McNeil from 1933 through December 1968. McNeil's 35-and-a-half-year run as host remains the longest tenure for an MC of a network entertainment program, surpassing Johnny Carson at 29-and-a-half years and Bob Barker at 34-and-a-half years. Let's listen to a little clip of this original program.
Presenting America's favorite, the Blue Network Breakfast Club with Don McNeil.
Good morning, Breakfast Club. Good morning to you. We got up bright and early, just howdy to you. The coffee's on the table set, there's bacon in the skillet, and Harry Cogan and his boys have fumes to fill it. So come on, gang, and gather around. We'll start this meeting.
That's how I'm going to start my show from now on.
Why not?
Why not?
I mean it. Why not?
Why not? Do a little sing and dance, a little soft shoe.
Yeah.
Throw a little hat around the studio. People think I'm just nuts.
Kane.
I vaguely Kane. Remember yeah. hearing the Breakfast Club still on WLS.
Yeah, it was ABC.
They carried it midday, mid-mornings, I think, around 10:05.
Mm-hmm.
For a half hour or so, and you said until 1968, but
yeah,
I can remember
crazy?
Hearing that in 67 or so.
35
really?
And a half years. Pretty crazy.
Yeah.
1940, Josh?
1940, Batman Comics. Mobsters rubbed out a circus highwire team known as the Flying Graysons, leaving their son Dick Robin an orphan, thus the introduction of Robin.
So that's how Robin came about. So there was some mobsters that killed the Flying Graysons, and Robin was the only one left. Dick
and
Grayson.
That's how Dick or Bruce Wayne and
yeah.
Dick Grayson became a ward of Bruce
yes.
Wayne.
Which I never understood what the ward was, but now I guess I do. Like it adopted, or he was put under his care.
Yeah.
Robin was a circus act.
Dick Grayson and the Graysons was a circus act, yeah.
That really was never explained in the
60s never.
TV show,
no,
was it?
Nope, he was just there.
Right.
And Harriet. Crazy Aunt Harriet. 1949. You're going to love this. I know you're going to love this, Dave. 1949, Captain Video and his Video Rangers debuted on the Dumont Television Network. First, I'm going to play a little clip of that.
Post. P-O-S-T. P-O-S-T. The cereals you like the most. The cereals made by Post. Take you to the secret mountain retreat of Captain Video. Electronic wizard, master of time and space, guardian of the safety of the world.
Now, Bruce Dumont will tell you that was the show he grew up with. Like, I grew up with Bozo, I grew up with Ray Rayner, I grew up with Bill Jackson. He would say he grew up with
Captain Video. It was a little before my time also. Yeah. You know, I'm with you, Garfield, Goose, Bozo, you know, of those. But Captain Video was from the 50s.
Yeah, and there's DVDs out there, believe it or not. We sell them at the Broadcast Museum at museum.tv. You can get those there. But my favorite, and you know what I'm going to tell you, remember the episode The Honeymooners? It was the first actual ever Honeymooners single episode. And it was when Ralph and Norton were sharing a TV, and Norton was a big fan of Captain Video. Let's take a listen.
Right. Attention, Rangers! I want all you Rangers at home to recite the Captain Video Ranger pledge. I, Edward Norton, Ranger, third class in the Captain Video Space Academy, do solemnly pledge to obey my mommy and daddy. Be kind to dumb animals and old ladies in and out of space.
Oh, was that it? Oh, that was it.
It ended?
Oh, man, we got to find the rest of that. Yeah, I guess that
was only halfway through it.
It was only halfway through it. That was absolutely a classic. And that was the first Honeymooners episode.
That was the first one?
Yeah. That was the first one. Because don't forget, it was a sketch first, and then it was a regular TV series for one season, the original 39 episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just a sketch on the Jackie Gleason show. 1955, the first automobile seatbelt legislation was enacted in Illinois. 1965, the first U.S. ground combat forces in Vietnam authorized by President Johnson. Let's take a listen to that presidential news conference.
This is a different kind of war. There are no marching armies or solemn declarations. Some citizens of South Vietnam, at times with understandable grievances, have joined in the attack on their own government. But we must not let this mask the central fact that this is really war. It is guided by North Vietnam and it is spurred by Communist China. Its goal is to conquer the South, to defeat American power, and to extend the Asiatic dominion of communism. And there are great stakes in the balance. Most of the non-communist nations of Asia cannot by themselves and alone resist the growing might and the grasping ambition of Asian communism.
And there you have it. That was the beginning, really the serious part of World War of the Vietnam War.
When it stepped up. You know, interesting comment that Lyndon Johnson makes there of this being war. It's a different kind of war. You know, he never really asked Congress for a declaration. You know, there was never a declaration of war from Congress for Vietnam, which is why all those years it was referred to as a conflict.
Right.
But, of course, he was obviously right.
You could tell there was just a different type of thoughtfulness and sincerity in his voice when talking about this.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Right. And who knew what was to come?
Yep, exactly. 1977,
Josh? Elvis Presley sings in Indianapolis, last performance of his career. He died August 17th, less than 2 months later.
Imagine being at the... I've never heard anyone interviewed, and I'm sure they're out there. I'm sure there's books written about somebody that was at Elvis's last concert.
I would think there would be.
Yeah.
Any video of it, maybe?
There might be. Yeah, there might be. I might have seen that, actually. I might have played some of that, actually, last year online. Have you been to Graceland, haven't you?
I have not.
You have not?
No, I have not.
That's going to be a next adventure for you and your dad. You got to go to Graceland.
Go to Graceland, yeah, okay.
It's pretty weird being there and walking through. It's literally like somebody's house you're walking through in the 1970s. It's just bizarre.
Yeah, I kind of understand that. I've talked with people that have been there, and I have some good friends that are real Elvis fans and have certainly made the trip there. So it's still in a neighborhood where, you know, there are other homes around it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like in a neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of crazy. 1980, David Letterman Show debuts his short-lived show on the NBC daytime long before late night. That was kind of like it was a daytime talk show, but it's kind of where he established a lot of his little
nuances
that he would do. Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely. And then in 1993, 13 years later, Late Night with David Letterman aired for the last time on NBC because he was going to CBS.
He went to
that
CBS.
Fall. So this week was his final show. And you remember who his last musical guest was? Because I do. It was phenomenal.
I do not.
Bruce Springsteen.
Oh, Springsteen.
He did Glory Days, and he was stomping all over the furniture. It was literally like a 6-7 minute rendition. It was absolutely fantastic.
Have you seen David recently with his interviews with Tom Brokaw?
Man, holy cow!
I don't want to say anything.
Yeah,
you don't want to say anything.
He just looks like he's having a good time.
He's enjoying himself.
There you go. You know, Josh, you're being discreet.
Yes, he is.
You're being discreet. Yes, you're being the objective reporter.
He is.
Thank you.
All right, we'll be back after this. 720 WGN. It is Sunday morning, and it's time for Walter Jacobson's perspective.
Uh-oh, look out. We're in for some bad stuff, you and I, and everyone else. 5 more months of Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton on television. A deluge of false information, misquotation, wild exaggeration, and lies, like Pinocchio. Anything they can find or contrive to demean each other on any subject they can think of. Orlando or San Bernardino, terrorism on our shores or war in the Middle East, race, religion, ethnicity, or gender, integration or immigration, you name it, for the next 5 months. Trump and Clinton will be spending hundreds of millions of dollars buying time on television to air their campaign commercials, muddy ones about Donald Trump being a casino cheater and a tax delinquent crook. Hillary Clinton being an email cheater and a charity foundation crook. Trump being a hound dog. Clinton's husband being a hound dog. The mud will fly. In their public debates, one-on-one, mano-a-woman-o, whatever mud they can muster, they will deliver. True or false doesn't matter. True or false, truth be damned. Bad stuff is big stuff on television. And the worse it gets, the more it's on television. So the mud game goes on, and everybody plays. In politics, mud wins elections. In television, mud wins ratings. We lose.
I'm Walter Jacobson, and that's my perspective. For more, visit WGNplus.com.
All right, Dave, what are you doing today with your dad? You're going to see him, I'm assuming, today?
I'm headed out there as soon as I'm done today. Yes, we're going to have lunch. He is picking the restaurant.
Nice.
And then if it isn't really, really stiflingly hot and humid, we're looking for a pretty hot, sticky day today. We may get in a little round of golf.
Ooh, very nice.
So
very nice.
That's what we've been discussing. So we'll see what happens.
And how old's your dad?
He is 94.
God bless him and wish him a happy Father's
Day. I will.
For
likewise
me as well.
To you, Dave, and to your dad.
Thank you very much. Josh, had a thrill that you joined us today.
Good to talk with you, Josh.
Thank you for having me on. Thank you.
It's been fun. It's been fun. We had a really good time. It was really great talking in the first half hour, too. And I love you, buddy. I'm glad you're here.
Happy Father's Day to you and all the fathers here and listening. And that's about it for me.
you got to come up with a more original sign-off than that, Josh.
Josh Plyer?
Josh Plyer, WGN Sports.
Okay, that'll work for today.
Thank you, Dave. I appreciate it. Have a wonderful day.
You too.
All right, my thanks to our overnight news team, Roger and Dave, our engineers, Aubrey and Bob, and to producer Joey Gelman, as always. Have a great Sunday, everybody, and happy Father's Day to you. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. It is 5, and here are the top stories with Mr. Dave Schwann.